From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Harvey Weinstein, the former Hollywood producer, was found guilty of rape and sexual abuse yesterday. He was acquitted of the most serious charges against him, including predatory sexual assault. Over time, more than 90 women came forward with their accounts of being assaulted by Weinstein. Actress Rosanna Arquette was one of the first. She spoke with NPR's All Things Considered yesterday, just after the verdict was announced.
It's positive. It's overwhelming. We're crying. This is justice. And it's not just justice. It's justice for all women. It sets a precedent. Although we prayed that he was going to be charged on all five counts, this is a great start. It really is.
But consider for a moment what it took to get here. Again, more than 90 women, some of them who were able to come forward for others, to use their celebrity while still taking a major risk to draw attention to Weinstein's actions. There were months upon months of deep investigation by some of the most dogged journalists in the country. Essentially, it took mountains of sustained public attention and political pressure to get to this moment. Doesn't that seem like an extremely high bar? Now, I'm not talking about the criminal standards within a courtroom once a trial begins. There are high bars around rules of evidence and reasonable doubt that are essential for the criminal justice system to function. What I'm wondering about is the bar for cultural change. So how much work is left to be done there? This hour on Point, the Weinstein verdict, and what's next in the Me Too movement. And we're going to begin today in Washington with Fatima Goss Graves. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of Time's Up, the legal defense fund, which helps workers connect with lawyers and bring cases involving workplace sexual harassment, regardless of their industry or rank. Fatima, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
So first of all, tell me, when the verdict finally came down yesterday, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction was truly relief and real gratitude to the dozens of women, the silence breakers, who told their stories even when they weren't guaranteed to have any particular outcome. And I went directly to thinking about, I hope that they felt a measure of relief and healing and justice in the verdict.
And so tell me more then about Weinstein having been found guilty on two of the five counts against him. You heard Ms. Arquette earlier saying that they were hoping for more, but this in and of itself felt like a major victory.
That's right. There were two of the counts that he was convicted on, and that's not insignificant, in part because our criminal justice system generally does not do very right by survivors. And when you think about what it will take for our systems to work effectively, we still have a long way to go. You know, I think that some people have raised a slight disappointment because they're, you know, on charges that looked at what really amounts to a pattern behavior that he wasn't convicted. But I have been focused on the two particular charges where he was convicted. And here's why. One of them involved a story that was very complicated. And what we saw happen in the courtroom and, frankly, outside of the courtroom is a meaningful effort to trot out every myth about sexual violence imaginable. Sort of, why did you still have contact with the person? Why did you do the thing that you do? All of it amounting to the idea that surely these people must be lying. And that isn't something that began with Harvey Weinstein, that you know, those are long-standing tropes we have had to live with culturally. And they will be the sorts of things that we will have to unravel for survivors to truly have the sort of justice that they need and deserve and for our country to move forward in a different way.
Well, so Fatima, since you mentioned that, I just want to play a clip where we're going to hear from Harvey Weinstein's defense attorney, Donna Rotunno. This was actually in an interview she gave to the New York Times podcast, The Daily, before the verdict was announced yesterday. So it's from quite a bit before. But you'll hear her talk about exactly what you just mentioned, Fatima, about whether or not women are to be believed when there's issues of patterns of behavior, because this is what they argued in court. So here is what Rotunno told The Daily.
you know, these are consensual encounters. We have communications at the time that I believe prove that they were consensual encounters. I believe the actions of women after the fact prove that they were consensual encounters. You know, when you look at real-time communications between two people, it really lends a very interesting spotlight into what was happening between two people at the time. And maybe the story being told today or in a courtroom is different.
So, Fatima, given that this was the argument that Weinstein's attorneys were making in the courtroom, and yet we still have these guilty verdicts on two counts, it seems that the jury was deadlocked on the other three. Does that change? Does that indicate a potential change in how the criminal justice system will look at future cases?
What I hope is it is a change in our culture, finally understanding what is typical for survivors, right? So she was putting out a range of ideas that actually were the opposite of typical behavior. She was suggesting that if you'd experienced sexual violence, there would be no way that you would ever contact your abuser again. Or she was suggesting that that you would report right away, or that there would be steps that you would take to heroically ensure that you were never raped at all. None of those things actually match reality. And so rather than relying on the stereotypes that we have about sexual violence that are so deeply ingrained, not only in our culture, but also our systems, we were able to rely on facts. And so to discount that sort of rhetoric, that is not at all valid. And so that piece of it makes me hopeful, because if you have a situation like the situation with Harvey Weinstein, where, as you said, you had, you know, over 80 people and you had two deep investigations by journalists and enough attention, I can't help but think about the many, many people who will never have mm-hmm. any of that mm-hmm. and who have the double burden of being brown and black and a survivor, or being queer and a survivor and even less likely right. to be believed.
Well, so this is exactly why I wanted to open the show this way, is to ask that question, because on the one hand, the verdict yesterday is a major moment in sort of the evolution of our understanding and our willingness to take action when it comes to workplace sexual assault and sexual harassment. There's no denying that. But to your point exactly, Fatima, beyond the Weinstein case, how much of a change are there significant ripple effects from what happened yesterday or not? That's what I'm curious about.
So here's the important ripple effect from the attention that the Weinstein case got. It is the idea that individuals can be believed, that they can have justice. Right? That gives people hope. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is that one person coming forward inspires another. Now it's all of our obligation, it's all of our duty to make sure that something important happens as a result of people coming forward. And the good news is the last 2 years, we have seen important changes. We've seen states improve their laws. We've seen companies understand that they have to actually do something serious about the issue of sexual violence, not just the typical burying your head in the sand approach. We've even seen individuals who come forward, you know, at the National Women's Law Center, we house and run the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. We've seen individuals come forward who are in situations where they know retaliation could follow them. And what they say again and again is, I was inspired by the person who came forward before me. If they can do it, I can do it. And that hope is not easily created. And I think that hope was sustained with yesterday's verdict. Mm.
Well, I want to let folks know that we definitely want to hear from our listeners this hour. What was your reaction when the verdict was announced yesterday against Harvey Weinstein? Do you see it as a major moment in the Me Too movement? Have you seen a difference in your workplace in the past couple of years in terms of how institutions or companies handle and respond to not only allegations of sexual assault or sexual harassment, but culture change that's really required for us to all move forward. So, Fatima, I hear you being being sort of optimistic, but even if it's a little cautiously optimistic, can you tell me, I mean, we've got about a minute to go before a break here, but since Time's Up was created, have you seen a growing number of women and men or people coming to you more than would have been a couple of years ago?
Well, you know, the Times Up Legal Defense Fund is really the first national program that connects individuals with both attorneys and storytelling assistants. And we've heard from thousands of people the last 2 years, about 4,000 people who are coming forward seeking assistance and who've been inspired by others. And we also have about 900 attorneys in our network. So it feels at this moment that Times Up Legal Defense Fund has become a force that is sort of bridging this gap in this moment where people are ready to come forward and they can't take on these systems alone.
Well, we are talking this hour with Fatima Goss-Graves. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And we are talking about the Harvey Weinstein verdict yesterday, whether it's a watershed moment in the Me Too movement and what work is left to be done to achieve the kind of cultural change across the board that's required for workers in every industry and every rank to feel safe and respected and valued. We want to hear from you. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the verdict against Harvey Weinstein, which was handed down in a New York courtroom yesterday, and how much work is left to be done, not only in the Me Too movement, but more deeply, just in American culture overall. I'm talking today with Fatima Goss-Graves. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And you might remember back in 2017, Time Magazine put on its cover as the person of the year, the silence breakers, as they called them. These were women in the Me Too movement. And one of them was Me Too creator Tarana Burke. And here's what she told Time back in 2017.
If somebody is bold and stands up and tells their story and you're not ready to do that, and that's not where you are in your journey, to just simply say Me Too is powerful, but it's soft. Me Too can be a conversation starter or it can be the whole conversation.
Well, Juana Molara was also amongst those honored by Time magazine in 2017. She's a former hotel housekeeper. She now advocates for hospitality employees in the California legislature, and she joins us from Los Angeles. Juana, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on your program, please.
Juana, would you first of all tell us what was your reaction? How did you feel when you heard about the verdict against Harvey Weinstein yesterday?
I was on my way to work yesterday morning when I heard over the radio, and I was, yes. I was really, really pleased with the results of this. All these women came out and spoke about what he did to them.
Why did this verdict matter to you?
Because sexual harassment, I work in the hospitality, and it is a big problem. If women before didn't stay quiet and keep it to themselves, not anymore. We're willing to do whatever it takes to stop this epidemic, because it's like an epidemic for for especially for room attendants, because we work in an isolated area and where there's no cameras, and we are exposed to anything. I mean, anything, any kind of danger in the floors while we're cleaning the rooms and scrubbing bathtub, scrubbing toilets. And people don't realize that, but that's what we go through every single day from minute one that we start working.
Now, Juana, if I may ask, and I hope it's okay that I do, but I'm wondering if you might, if you're willing to just share one or two of the experiences that, that you had so that people understand really sort of what you're saying and what happened to you that led you to become an advocate for your fellow housekeepers in the industry.
It's I was working in another property, not in the one that I that I'm working right now, and I was it was a Sunday, and I was working as usual by myself in the floors. Sundays is almost for sure that is a high percentage of vacant rooms that you're gonna clean. So hotels are usually getting empty, and I was cleaning this room when I was scrubbing one of the bathtubs, and I suddenly felt like someone was looking at me. I turned around, and there was this guy already inside the room. I didn't hear a thing that he went inside, and he was just staring at me, how I moved, how what I was doing. Immediately, I asked him to get out because I knew that the room wasn't, it didn't belong to him. So he got out. I went to my lunch, and I went right after I finished my lunch, I went back to the same room to finish up the making the bed, dusting, vacuuming. And I was searching for something on my car to put on the room, to complete my room. And when suddenly I saw this same guy that I had already came in the, inside the room, and he was exposing his private part, totally erected. I mean, I was so scared. I saw the worst that was going to happen to me because I knew how he easily got inside the room without even me noticing or realizing that he was already inside. And he was asking me some random questions, and I was answering the question, but screaming, making, trying to make loud voice. So if anybody was inside any other room, came out and see what was going on. But that all the rooms were empty. Nobody came. For some reason, the minute he even had the guts to say that why I was answering so loud, if I was scared, and I say no, I'm not scared. I mean, I was dying inside my inside me because I said, my God, why did he move the car? I mean, a woman compared to a man's strength is nothing. And suddenly, I don't know what he did. He, I mean, he even had the guts to tuck his shirt inside his pants. So his private part could expose really, really everything. I mean, everything.
Fatima, if I'm sorry to, I am sorry to interrupt here, but I just want to ask very briefly: was he an employee or not an employee?
No, he wasn't an employee.
Okay, and
At the end, I closed the door because he went to another floor, and I called for help. It took like maybe 20 minutes. 30 minutes, somebody came up to the, to my my room, and nothing was done. That guy ran away. I made a report to the police, and nothing changed. I mean, I mean, we need laws that can protect us, like
right.
the one we have here in Long Beach. We recently won a measure WW, and now hotels are more protected and with the panic buttons.
Right. Well, so Juana, practically speaking, okay, so you mentioned that there are some laws that have been enacted in various places, recently mm-hmm. in Long Beach, as you were just mentioning. But practically mm-hmm. speaking, what more do you think should be done in the hospitality industry now, these many years later? Has enough been done?
I think we don't it step by step. Maybe it's not. All enough. There's more to be done. More places that have measures like the one we had in Long Beach. Just to say, mention another place. Last year, we tried hard to pass a measure ballot in Rancho Palos Verdes, and we weren't successful because Terranea invests over $1 million to fight it back, and so we wouldn't be successful in winning that law.
Terranea, the hotel company.
That hotel Terranea.
Yeah.
So the employees would have had the panic buttons along with the Trans Gulf.
I see. So Juana, hold on here for a second. Hold on for a moment. And Fatima, I really appreciate and thank you for your patience in listening to Juana's story. But pick up on the thought that Juana just left us with, that in the hospitality industry, we're still seeing companies push back against efforts to ensure worker safety. Juana was talking there about the hotel group spending a lot of money to resist passage of laws that would require panic buttons for hospitality workers. I mean, what's your thought about that?
Well, first, thank you for telling your story and for your advocacy. I think we're at a time that is not like any other. And so the idea that the hospitality industry would do anything but support measures to ensure that hotel workers are safer is absurd. And, you know, for many, many years, you could defeat these sorts of measures without having a lot of attention to it. And the last 2 years, that has not been the case. We are now seeing states put forward measures that are covering all workers, that are requiring more safety measures, that are saying even if you're an independent contractor, you deserve to work with safety and dignity. Even if you're a domestic worker, you deserve to work with safety and dignity. In fact, especially because you are a worker who might be vulnerable to further abuse, we really want to make sure that you are protected. And so, you know, you can either in these points in history decide to be with the change and shaping it for the future or opposing it, but those who are opposing it are not going to win in the end.
Well, Juana, I have to let you go in about a minute here, but I was wondering if you would share a last thought with us about what would you like to see happen next? You talked about those laws. Are there things that people, individuals, can do that more companies should be doing?
Keep talking and keep spreading the message that if you stay quiet, nothing is going to change. But if we speak out, all together, we can do something about it. And the example is right here in Long Beach. We fought hard and we won it. And I think if there's another, if we spread it like this, we won't have any more women suffering in silence about what they go through every day.
Well, Juana Malara, she was among those honored by Time magazine in 2017 as a Person of the Year. call them the silence breakers. She now advocates for hospitality employees. She advocates in the California legislature. Joined us today from Los Angeles. Juana, thank you so, so much for being with us.
No, thanks to you for having me.
Well, let's go to our phones. Let's go to our callers. Maria is calling from New York City. Maria, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So I'm in listening to the program so far, I kind of have some comments. Well, first I'll briefly describe what I went through. I was new to a job for a government agency, a very large government New York City agency. And within the first 2 months, my boss, who was the head of HR, groped me. I was an HR executive, so I wasn't new to HR, and I knew, you know, what the laws were, what my rights were. But I was hesitant to file a complaint because this is a very powerful person. And I was new and didn't want to lose my job. After a few months, when I realized the harassment would not stop, I went forward with a complaint. But you know, I did it in a very strategic way where I collected the evidence because I knew it would be my word against his. And in the end, after the investigation, my complaint, EEO complaint, was substantiated and he was allowed to resign because a procedure was started that would fire him eventually. So he resigned and I thought that was a victory. Mm. I was very happy with that. But what ended up happening was when I went back to work after he was gone, his allies retaliated against me. And I was a senior member of the HR department myself, but I wasn't there long enough to really have the allies. So I had the retaliation, and because I had worked for a previous boss prior to that, I asked to be moved under that boss. I had a good reputation, and he was more than happy to take me. So I did that, and that provided cover, and I thought, okay, no one knows what happened. I can start fresh, and I can still have my career. Well, after a few months, I found out that everyone knew.
Yeah.
And not only did everyone know, everyone knew my name. I was the person who got the head of HR fired. The job that I ended up getting was, you know, the same pay, and I had the same title, but it really shelved me because I didn't have as much responsibility and the scope of influence wasn't as vast, and I didn't get to help people directly the way I did in the HR field.
Maria, you're going to have to forgive me for stepping in here, but we have, I'm looking at our clock, and we're going to have to take a break here in just about a minute or a minute and a half or so. I'm just wondering if you could, what's your question for Fatima or the thought that you want to share with us?
Right. So I thought it was a victory, but in the end, it really wasn't. Like, what happens to those of us who are there and now our reputations are damaged because, oh, you must have been having an affair with him, which my case proved that I wasn't. It was very well documented. You know, what happens to us? And then when we do decide to sue, I couldn't find an attorney that wanted to actually go to court and have a trial. They wanted me to settle. Oh, you proved your case. You're going to get money. I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to court, and I wanted the agency that allowed him to resign to have to answer because there was a culture for this in the agency. And then I also tried to get Time's Up help, but I needed to have an attorney first, and I didn't want to sign with an attorney because they wouldn't agree to go to court.
Okay, so Maria, thank you so much for sharing your story and for your call. Fatima, we've got about a minute before we have to take a break here, but your first thoughts on, I mean, Maria's talking about the long-term consequences of even choosing to come forward with a complaint.
Well, there's no question that for the many different types of silence breakers, whether or not your abuser is as famous as Harvey Weinstein, there are real costs. I mean, at the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, we hear often that people try to go through their current systems. They experience harassment, but then when they go through their current systems, they often experience retaliation. That's one of the shifts that we need to make in our culture for institutions to know and understand that it is better for them to fix it than to retaliate for people. And in some ways, our laws need to change to make that a reality.
Well, we are talking this hour about the verdict against Harvey Weinstein yesterday and what work is left to be done in American workplaces. We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the verdict handed down yesterday in the case against Harvey Weinstein and what, if any, work remains to be done in the Me Too movement and whether or not yesterday's verdict was a watershed moment in the Me Too movement. I'm joined by Fatima Goss-Graves. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. And joining us now from New York is Jodi Kantor. Jodi, along with her colleague Megan Twohy, both from the New York Times, they are Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters who first broke the story about Harvey Weinstein and his sexual harassment behavior, to say the least. Jodi and Megan are co-authors of the 2018 book, She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite a Movement. Jodi Kantor, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
So first of all, have you been in touch with many of the women who you've been speaking to over the years in the wake of the Weinstein verdict yesterday? And if so, what have they told you?
I have. I actually delivered the news to Ashley Judd yesterday. I called her and I told her just really a few minutes after the guilty verdict what had happened. And she took a second and she just said, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it's supposed to be.
Huh. And then what did she mean by that? What more did she tell you?
I think what she meant is that Harvey Weinstein's signature was lack of accountability. This is a man who manipulated people, who pressured them to sign non-disclosure agreements, paid people off, often intimidated and threatened people, according to numerous sources and former employees. And the idea that he is finally facing accountability, I think, meant a tremendous amount to different people. Some people felt closure. Some people felt hope. Some people felt satisfaction. But I think when you look at the power of Me Too, it's really accountability that's driven the whole thing. The idea that there are consequences for this kind of behavior is what caused other people to come forward in the first place.
Jodi, you've been following this story for so long now. I wonder what you make of the fact that he was found guilty on those two counts against him, but not all of them. What are the implications of that?
It was a mixed verdict, which I think is actually pretty symbolic of where Me Too is at. It is very hard to resolve these issues in society. And remember that the jury was charged with interpreting a lot of complicated questions about consent. This was by no means, a sort of straightforward set of allegations. And so I think we as a society asked a lot of these jurors. We asked them to go into a room and fully resolve things that the rest of us have not really worked out.
And you and Megan wrote a story just yesterday for the Times following the verdict. And in it, you remind us of the 2018 verdict against Bill Cosby. The Cosby and the Weinstein verdicts taken together, do you think that we're seeing a change in terms of, I mean, as you and Megan put it at the end of your story, people's acceptance of the quote-unquote messiness of these kinds of cases and what it takes to prove what happened in a court of law?
That's the question. I mean, these are two very high-profile cases, but especially in the Weinstein trial, part of the significance of the verdict comes from the fact that this was a really long-shot case in a lot of ways. It was risky for the prosecutors. Some fellow prosecutors didn't even think the New York DA was right to move forward. And so then the fact that they won this victory means that they may have done something to shift the boundaries of sex crimes prosecutions and whose stories get heard.
I know I only have you for like another minute or two more, Jodi, because I imagine you're still very busy. But
sorry, I am on deadline.
No,
I do have to go.
It's no problem. I just want to ask you one last question. I mean, as I'm just wondering if I can ask you to step just a hair outside your role as a reporter for a moment and just reflect with me on what this moment meant to you and to Megan in terms of all the work that you put in to do the investigations that drove this issue into the public mind. What did the verdict mean to you?
Well, thank you for asking that. I mean, what I would say is that the meaning of this work was clear to me from within the very first phone calls to the very first brave women who told us their stories. And we did this work without knowing what we would find, what we or others would uncover, what the extent of the allegations, or now we can say crimes, would turn out to be. And we had no idea whether Weinstein would be prosecuted or not and what would result from that prosecution. You do the story just to find the truth, knowing that journalism may be the only form of accountability that he faces, or knowing that it could lead to something more.
Well, Jodi Kantor is the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times, co-author with Megan Twohy of She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite a Movement. Jodi, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Maya, who's calling from Detroit. Maya, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Maya.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Maya.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just wanted to make a comment regarding the Weinstein case, the results. I was a little bit disappointed, although it's great that he was convicted of something. It just, I feel like it just expressed or demonstrated the rape culture that is still deeply embedded in our society and the impunity that sexual predators and sexual harassers still maintain within our entire society across the country. You know, when you have Polaris and the RAIN organizations describing how, you know, 80% on average, 80% of rape victims do not report, and then of the group that does report, less than 10% of those sexual predators are sought for and even brought to the justice system. Of that group, less than 3% are brought to trial. And of that group, less than 1% receive any prison or jail time. You know, we still have yet to see whether Weinstein's going to get any prison or jail time, but it's this impunity that, you know, is so consistent in our system and in our society where women's safety because of rape culture and the misogyny within that fuels it. Women are not believed. You know, women's safety is dismissed constantly. You know, and we can implement all kinds of things and programs and processes within our workplaces to make women, you know, safer, to you know, ease, you know, the state of reporting. But at the end of the day, when we do not hold, you know, predators accountable, this is not going to change.
Maya, thank you for your call and your thoughts. Fatima, do you want to respond to that?
Well, she's absolutely right that the culture work that's so deep is not done. And it is going to take a lot of work to ensure that the Weinstein conviction isn't the beginning and the end, right? There is a whole movement of people who are committed to actually driving something different for the future, to undoing the many, many rape myths that mean that women just aren't believed, and to improve our systems so that they actually work for survivors. There's no question that they don't work right now. That's true for the criminal justice system. That's also true for workplace systems and for our courts more broadly. But what makes me hopeful is before 2 years ago, there wasn't a movement that had been winning in terms of driving change. And in the last 2 years, 15 states have changed their laws. So I see the possibility of doing some things that actually makes things different for that next generation. But it is not going to happen on its own. Power never concedes anything on its own. It's going to take a lot of work.
So, Fatima, remind us of those 15 states. What exactly have they changed?
Well, for some of the states, they're actually covering all workers. They're covering independent contractors, people who are working in smaller workplaces, interns, the idea that all work is safe work. In other places, they're getting rid of the sort of pre-dispute non-disclosure agreements, the idea that just to work someplace, you sign away all your rights in a non-disclosure, which many, many companies have as routine. In other places, they're adjusting the statute of limitations period. One of the hard things is you have to be able to come forward really, really fast, but that's not how it actually works for more survivors. By the time they are ready to come forward, their time sometimes has long passed, and it is too late to get any sort of justice from our legal system. And so there are a basket of issues at the federal level. There is a bill called the Be Heard in the Workplace Act. And for the first time, Congress has a bill that basically says all work should be safe work. You would think that that is not an unusual thing, but it did not exist before.
Mm. Well, let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. I was grateful that the jurors in the Weinstein case did not buy the defense argument that the communication subsequent to the assault meant that Weinstein was somehow not guilty. I'm wondering if your guests can comment on the psychological reasons for the enlightenment of some listeners, perhaps, why some victims do subsequently communicate and have some kind of relationship with their accuser. And I just applaud the women that went through this for coming forward ultimately against Mr. Weinstein. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Jennifer, thank you for that question. I mean, Fatima, I think one of the first reasons might be because the women had no choice.
Right. I mean, one of the things that was a particular point about Weinstein is what a powerful figure he was in the industry, in the sector, shaping their ability to work at all. So one of the reasons that people continue to have contact with their abusers is because they control their lives, they control their futures, they control their ability to work. And that was a dynamic that played out here, but plays out in lots of sectors, especially when there's really powerful individuals who act as gatekeepers for entire sectors. But it also is important to just note that there's lots of myths about sexual violence that don't actually track reality. For example, people can be raped even if they have already had consensual sex with someone before. Right? Mm. Those two things can happen. It just means that that instance, they did not want to have sex. Right? The second thing is that sometimes people end up having encounters later. Right? Even physical encounters later with someone who raped them. Right? So actually understanding what is more typical behavior for survivors, something that is not unusual, is a helpful thing for our culture. Understanding that people rarely tell anyone right away. So if the only evidence that you're looking for is the fact that someone either went to the police or told their best friend or wrote it down in real time, you might not ever get that information because most people don't report through formal channels because they don't think anything important will happen.
Mm. Let's get one more call here. Let's go to David, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. So my experience with the Me Too and sexual harassment, sexual assault stems from two places. I recently transitioned out of the service, and in the service, we got extensive training on sexual assault and sexual harassment. Annually, I believe it was. Maybe some units did it more often. But as I transitioned into the civilian side, I didn't see any of that. And I also saw that sexual comments and sort of behavior that would not have been okay in the service kind of happened more prevalently. So I think, though, the training sort of becomes, a lot of people, griped and moaned about it because you knew what kind of training you were getting, every year. It brought to the forefront the conversation of sexual harassment and sexual assault and what was and what wasn't allowed, resources that were available for survivors. And it made the conversation a little bit more normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what that also a second and third order effect was that if you saw sexual harassment or if you saw somebody that was feeling uncomfortable, I, as a man, could have done something to the point where I could have been like, hey, are you okay? Like, was that okay for you? It kind of allowed me to be a helping hand to somebody that may or may not be feeling okay.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for that call. Fatima, David's call, he's talking about training he received in the military. And the military has done a lot of work on this, but although I guarantee you that it won't be any surprise for you to hear that I'm sure a lot of members of the military believe there's still much more work left to be done as well. But David's call makes me wonder, we have been talking about cultural and systemic change in the workplace through things that employers can do, through laws, through measures of accountability, et cetera. But we're not really going to get there, across the finish line to a better place until we craft a culture from the bottom up where quite simply, it's not okay that people just believe understand that it is not okay to harm or abuse or harass another person. I mean, we have to change who we all are. And that's probably the work of a generation, but it's got to start at the youngest ages, doesn't it?
There's no question about that. But sometimes culture changes pretty rapidly. And I actually think that that is the period that we're in right now. That's why it feels so unsettling to people, that things that maybe they thought were okay a few years ago, they now are understanding are not okay. And that means that they actually have to change, right? And so that discomfort we're experiencing is good. And I actually think when you think about institutions, whether it is the military or schools or workplaces, they have an opportunity to intervene in a number of important ways. They are containers that can create culture and set norms within those institutions, and they can set rules and policies that actually make a difference. So I actually lean in at our work at the National Women's Law Center, we lean in to institutions as important drivers of change. Mm.
Well, Fatima Gosgraves is the president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which helps workers connect with lawyers and possibly bring cases involving workplace sexual harassment, regardless of their industry or their rank. Fatima, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks so much.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim, with help from Caroline Love and Bradley Noble. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.